Please silence all electronic devices.
Representatives Brawley, Sain, Hastings, Martin, Setzer, and Soka are recognized.
So the bottom line is, folks, there are a lot of bad people out there.
I'm Elizabeth Dole, and I approve this message.
You're fired!
You know, the guy that used to sit in this chair had a saying, if you think everybody's good, you ain't met everybody.
Any further discussion or debate?
From the 4th Estate Lounge in downtown Raleigh, this is the WNC Politics Podcast. I'm Jeff Tiberi. Glad to have you along as always. Today we're chatting about the veto override that was not negotiating that state budget. And yes, liquor today on the podcast. Your guest is Colin Campbell, columnist for the NC Insider. Glad to have you back on the pod. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
We're going to start with what is a very contentious topic, and it played out yesterday. We think for the final time, at least this bill, played out on Wednesday at the legislature. As a bit of a reminder in context, this was the Born Alive Act that legislators passed, I believe, in March. It was in response to a couple of things, some rolling back of late-term abortion regulations in New York and Virginia, also coincided with a challenge to a 20-week abortion ban in North Carolina. The 20-week abortion ban was effectively struck down. And it led to this new bit of policy, which would have punished doctors with felony criminal charges and also perhaps levied significant fines against doctors who did not care for babies who were born alive following late-term abortions. So to set the policy aside for a moment, I mean, the policy and the politics is very much woven together on this, but policy was passed, goes to the governor, he vetoes it, and big picture from me, from my money, this was really the first test, significant test we've had of what is a little bit more divided government since the supermajorities were ended. So from your perspective, the political side of this, it might be done from in terms of the debate within this building, but do you anticipate that we're going to hear a lot more about this issue and how people voted as we head toward 2020?
Oh, yeah. I mean, this is going to be a campaign ad. I already saw somebody tweeting out a picture of the Democrats who'd voted against it, calling them the infanticide four. So you're going to be hearing lots of ads from the Republicans saying that various Democrats, including the governor, support essentially killing babies. You'll also hear from Democrats who point out that, argue at least, that Republicans are trying to take steps back in the woman's right to an abortion and right to choose. So we have not heard the last of this, even though there's probably not going to be another vote on this topic for the rest of the two-year session.
So I quickly to that point, just to follow up, the way the vote went yesterday, it was a 67-53 vote, and there were two Democrats who voted with the 65 Republicans. The only way that I'm aware of that this issue could come back up is if one of the 53 Democrats, while there were fewer of them, they were on the prevailing side because the override effort needed 72 votes yesterday. If any of those 53 Democrats were to make a motion to reconsider the override, the motion, they could reconsider and then they could vote to override it again. But there's no indication that's going to chicanery is never too far away around here, but there's no indication that's
going to happen. Yeah, we were watching closely yesterday to see if any Republicans who ultimately did support the bill would choose to vote with the Democrats in at least to open up that avenue in the future, and none did. They all Republicans, with no exceptions, voted to override the governor's veto. So we won't see that happening unless they were able to somehow convince one of the Democrats. And granted, there are two Democrats who switched from being supportive of the bill initially to opposing it on this override vote. But I think it would be unlikely that you could convince them to change their mind again and want to go back and reconsider this issue.
You alluded to this loaded rhetoric. You know, the Democrats were quick to and I don't believe I heard the word access. I'm not remembering if I did, but we heard the word access earlier on in the debate around this piece of policy. But it doesn't really deal with access per se. It's different than some of the pieces of legislation that we've seen in Mississippi and Alabama recently. But that's where the Democrats went to initially. The Republicans were, I mean, it's worth noting again, just because it was so preposterous. Jerry Tellman in a Senate committee a couple months back said that, you know, doctors had been assisting in the deaths of children, which if you're going to make a claim like that, a little evidence. Some
back
data,
it up somehow.
Some witness. I mean, it's important, I think, as a journalist, it's important to try to support that somehow. As charged up as things were yesterday, Were there any facts that stood out to you?
Not much. You know, this is it's frustrating to watch a debate like this as a journalist because it goes on for months and it remains a fact-free debate. PolitiFact has looked into a lot of the claims made on this and found a significant number of falsehoods on both sides of the aisle, and that doesn't seem to really encourage politicians to kind of moderate their rhetoric and stick to the facts more. They just keep pushing the same avenues. And I think it's just because abortion is such an emotional issue that everyone just goes to their battle stations and sort of pushes the same arguments, even if they don't necessarily apply to the facts of the policy currently being debated. I mean, if we were really having a fact-based debate yesterday, you would have heard Republicans say, look, we know this is hardly ever happens at all, and when it does, there's probably statutes on the books that would help it, but just to be extra safe, maybe we should have another statute that more clearly spells out this situation just to make sure prosecutors have the tools they need if it ever happened here in North Carolina. That, of course, was not their argument. Their argument was that, you know, Democrats are supporting infanticide. If you had a more logical argument from Democrats, and I think some of them, to their credit, did make this argument, would be that the bill is unnecessary and that there's a concern that it might have unintended consequences that would have a negative effect on medical providers in certain situations related to abortion. So those would be the fact-based arguments, but we didn't hear most of those because everyone just goes to their standard claims of, oh, Republicans are trying to restrict abortion rights, or, oh, Democrats want to kill babies.
Colin Campbell here on the podcast. It's a tricky one to work through as a reporter because, you know, our job is to be fair to both sides, as fair as we can be. There's a lot of spin that was moving along with this one. And I did find that it changed a little bit. The framework of the arguments from both sides has changed slightly over the last couple of months. As we think about this as a political issue, do you have a sense or an expectation as to whether or not this is going to be of widespread importance, talked about a lot in 2020, if it's really going to be in just a few swing districts, or perhaps if this was a big impassioned debate here, but we're not, maybe you and I and the media are making a little bit too much of this, and we're not going to hear much about this in 2020. Do you have a read?
You know, I think a lot of it's going to depend on the national headwinds. You know, all politics these days tend to get nationalized, and the abortion issue certainly has, based on much more impactful, significant policy restricting abortion rights in other states, and that's gotten people riled up. So I think to the extent that that's still going on in 2020, this is the issue that they're going to hit on to try to bring that up at this level. So what I think you may see is some contested primaries. I think some, you know, we've already heard from Democrats who want to challenge Senator Don Davis, who voted against the override back in the Senate when it passed there. We also could see some challenges perhaps in the general election against some of the more moderate rural Democrats. I think some of the ones that had changed their votes come to mind. Representative James Galliard, who is a pastor in the Rocky Mount area and a Democrat, voted for the bill initially against it on this override vote. And he's been all over Twitter today trying to justify his change of mind and change of heart on this issue. I think recognizing that there's a lot of people who may disagree with him one way or the other in his district.
Right. One of the other things I do wonder about, and I haven't seen any indicators of this yet, but I do think a vote like yesterday and subsequently the quotes that follow in the newspapers and on the radio and the clips that you'll see on social media from the television stations, I think those can be used by lawmakers in both parties to drum up financial support, campaign contributions, as in, look at what they're not doing in Raleigh, look at what I'm doing. I mean, I think that this is an effort, a vehicle in some ways, probably on a secondary level, to try to raise money.
It really fires up everybody's bases, and you can definitely tell just from social media traffic and sort of conversations with people who aren't super engaged in politics, this has gotten people's attention in ways that a lot of the more policy-driven, less politically divisive action of this legislative session has not gotten that same level of attention.
Couple of just housekeeping notes here. This was the first veto that Cooper, Democratic Governor Roy Cooper, issued since the supermajorities were upended in November and the slightly more balanced majority minority parties were seated in January. He issued 28 vetoes in the first 2 years he was in office. 23 of those were overridden. So I don't think it's fair to say we know how the next 27 override votes will go, but clearly this was representative of the fact that social policies that tilt far to the right are not going to be easily overridden here anymore, at least until early 2021.
Yeah, and the caucuses are united enough where it's going to be very difficult, I think, on any policy issue, but particularly social issues like this one, for Republicans to be able to peel off some of the more moderate or conservative Democrats to vote their side and manage to successfully override Cooper's veto.
On Twitter, at Raleigh Reporter. His name is Colin Campbell. He is the editor of the NC Insider State Government News Service from the News and Observer. So we do expect, we don't know this for a fact, but we do think that it's fairly likely the governor will veto the budget once he gets it at some point later in June. But before he can get a budget, before we can sift through it, the House and the Senate need to come to some sort of compromise on their spending plan. Last week, the Senate approved its version of the budget for the fiscal year, which starts July 1st. The House had previously done so. So I want to chat with you for just a couple of minutes about some of the differences between these two chambers. They have agreed on a big number, the total spend, which of course is important, but now we've got some differences when it comes to raises and environmental funding and disaster relief. What strikes you as the 2 or 3 or 17, however many you really want to tick off, differences between the chambers and what they have to work through?
Yeah, you know, I think the raises are going to be the big one, because you do have, like I said, the spend number is always a controversial issue. That's been settled. They're largely in agreement on tax policy, which has a lot to do with, you know, how much revenue you have available for other spending. But you've got this issue on, you know, the House or the Senate wants to do more for the rank and file state employees. The House is tilting the benefit more towards teachers. And so the teacher raises are higher. So where they meet in the middle on that, I think, is going to take a little while to figure out, in part because we have sort of a long-term discussion on what to do about veteran teachers. Do we give them significant raises because they've been in the field for 30 years, or do you give them bonuses and try to make the teaching profession sort of top out, you know, when you're 15 or 20 years in, so you don't have to work for 30 years before you make the top of the pay scale? That's one. The other one that I've been watching that's gotten a little bit less attention is disaster relief funding. We had special sessions last year where we set aside a lot of money for Hurricane Florence. Now it's time to figure out how do we spend that on what sort of projects. And the House wants to go ahead and set aside, I think, a little upwards of $80 million of that money to specific things, including a lot of like home buyout projects, trying to fill in the gaps of the always slow to arrive federal disaster relief money. The Senate wants to spend quite a bit less, I think under $30 million. And theirs proposal is a little more wide-reaching. They've got money for Surrey County, which is, you know, north of Winston-Salem, nowhere near the coast, but did have some flood issues related to Hurricane Michael, and they've got some projects that they want to do in that. Of course, Surrey County, part of Senate Leader Filberger's district, also in that area is Greensboro. They've got some money in the Senate budget for Greensboro's tornadoes from last year. So all of these things are going to have to be worked out, and all of it's going to get worked out behind closed doors. It'll be interesting to see how closely the budget writers stick to their guns, knowing that you have to get through the step of passing a compromise budget before it can go to the governor, and then you have to figure out how you're going to compromise with the governor if he vetoes, which he probably will. So there may be some of the stuff may get kicked down the road just in for the sake of getting something moving.
To that point, and I set this whole portion of our conversation up with, we're expecting a veto from the governor. That's my expectation. He has vetoed the last two budgets. But as we're sitting here and talking about this, and let's just say for conversation's sake, I'm going to throw some numbers out here. But if we say, you know, 3 to 3.5% raise for teachers, 3% raise for state employees, I'm splitting the difference between the House and Senate, $60, $65 million in disaster relief, and a number of other things. Is there a scenario under which the governor, in your opinion, might lean toward possibly signing this? Is there, rephrase this way, is there a budget compromise, a feasible budget compromise that you think we could see here in the next two and a half weeks that the governor might be willing to sign?
I'd say if you didn't have Medicaid expansion in the debate this year. I think on a lot of the issues, there's probably room to compromise and come up with this, you know, an agreement relatively quickly. But because the governor has pretty much drawn a line in the sand that he's only going to sign a budget that includes Medicaid expansion, and so far there's been no movement towards that here in the legislature, aside from a plan in the House that hasn't even necessarily gotten the majority support of the Republican caucus, I think we're going to be a ways away. And I think the more likely scenario is that we have a budget impasse that lasts perhaps quite a while, which would keep government running based on the way they've sort of restructured laws. But what I think you could see is some of these other pieces get broken down, and the legislature sends him different bills with different pieces of the budget that they want to go ahead and enact into law for things like teacher raises, things that people don't want to wait on until they figure out how do you solve this impasse over Medicaid.
And it almost feels as though if they – it's a dangerous game from their perspective to play, because if you start dealing piecemeal with, well – we need to do these raises for these folks, and this county needs X number of dollars, and that county has a failing sewer system, and we're going to give them X number of dollars or appropriate X number of dollars. It becomes really hectic if you start to do this stuff piecemeal, potentially. But that's what they're going to have to. I think that's one way in which this could come to a head in terms of brokering, reaching just a big budget agreement. Whether it's weeks after July 1st or whether we don't get really that two-year spending plan for a much longer period of time.
Yeah, exactly.
So we're waiting on that. Much more to come on the budget as June and July and the rest of the months in 2019 progress. Let's shift gears here and chat about liquor. You wrote a little bit about a bill that deals with craft distillers this week. Tell us effectively what the loosening of the regulations would do and where things stand.
Yeah, so this is an interesting bill. If you're the sort of person who enjoys getting a locally made alcoholic beverage at a neighborhood place that does it themselves, this might be one of the most impactful bills on your drinking life this current General Assembly. The current law is interesting because it treats liquor very differently from wine and beer. If you go to a craft brewery or a winery, you can go there. You can get as many glasses of the product, the beer, the wine, as you want. You can hang out. There are food trucks. There's usually kids running around. You go to a craft distillery, and it's a much different experience. You will pay money. You'll take a tour. You'll have to take a tour in order to do anything else while you're there. And then they will offer you quarter-ounce samples of straight liquor. So if you're a sort of person who enjoys a cocktail, but your shot-taking days may have been left behind in college, as mine have,
I'll join that crew,
you can't try somebody's craft rum in a cocktail unless you buy a bottle, and you can buy only up to five if you take the tour. Otherwise, you're going to the ABC store, and you'll have to make the cocktail for yourself at home.
Right.
So that's obviously a big economic hindrance on the development of craft distilleries in North Carolina and their ability to have the same level of success as craft beer has. So the bill that is going through the Senate right now, sponsored by Senator Rick Gunn, the big piece of it would allow craft distilleries to serve mixed drinks, beer and wine, so it becomes sort of a neighborhood hangout, and they're able to showcase what they can do with their liquor products in a way that they can't right now. It would also lift the cap on how many bottles you can buy while you're there before you have to go to an ABC store to get it. And the sort of moving piece of this is the distillers trying to reach an agreement with the ABC stores, and they seem to have reached that as of this week. Originally, the bill called for the distilleries to be able to sell their products directly to restaurants and bars without going through the ABC system. The ABC system, understandably, not a big fan of that. So now there's a new mechanism in the bill that would basically make it easier for a bar that goes to their local ABC store, wants a particular craft distiller's product, can't get it through the ABC store. This would allow that distillery to ship directly to the store if there's a request, so that somebody who wants to buy two bottles, try it for their neighborhood bar to see if it works out and sells, has that ability to experiment, and it gets the distiller's product in more restaurants and bars.
Obviously backed by proponents of the free market. Some of that opposition you mentioned in the form of the ABC boards and stores. What about religious social conservatives on this? Is there another significant oppositional hurdle to clear?
I think so. There was a speech from at the committee meeting the other day from Reverend Mark Creech of the Christian Action League, always an opponent of a lot of alcohol loosening legislation. And his concern, I think, boils down to worrying about sort of the slow dismantling of the ABC system. There's, of course, another bill that I think probably has a higher mountain to climb that would completely privatize the ABC system and get the government out of the alcohol sales business. And religious conservatives feel very strongly that that's necessary to keep consumption in line and sort of prevent alcoholism problems from growing worse. And there's a concern that the more you allow the distilleries to directly sell their own product, the further you get from the traditional ABC system.
Have you been, and I had to pull it up, I have been there, Lassiter Distilling Company, right in your neck of the woods.
Yeah, close to me in Knightdale. I've been meaning to get over there. I actually may for a column in the next couple weeks, just to sort of see what the experience is like. But watching them sort of be proponents for downtown Knightdale, which is not really that much of a downtown because it's a suburban community that's grown a lot in the last few years.
Small to very small.
But they have a storefront in the center of downtown with a big sign that says distillery, and I think it attracts people from around the triangle to visit one of the suburban towns that they might not otherwise have a reason to go to.
It's a neat spot. I stumbled upon it. I was sober when I stumbled upon it after pizza a while back. But a cool spot, and I believe they do rum, if I'm remembering
correctly.
You mentioned your column. We're going to tick through a couple here with a little more brevity. You are a columnist for the NC Insider. However, your column writing days are going to come to a pause here at the end of the month. Tell us why, and tell us what columns you're still hoping to produce.
This was sort of a difficult decision for us because I really do enjoy sort of putting on my pundit hat once a week and getting to inject a little bit of hopefully nonpartisan opinion about political news. And but the way we do that is it's a syndicated column through what's called the Capital Press Association, and it's going to a lot of smaller papers around the state who have sort of paid in for the ability to run this and some other columns that we distribute. The problem with the media business model these days is a lot of smaller papers are sort of struggling for cash, and so they're looking to save money in a way they can. So there's fewer papers that take the column. It's less of a revenue product for the Insider and for my company now. So there's a desire for me to focus more on the reporting side for the Insider and less on sort of writing a general interest column that goes out to a lot of papers since it's just not necessarily that much financially successful syndication thing anymore. So it's sort of bittersweet because I do enjoy doing it, but it will be nice to have more time to report. And I think sort of in the last few weeks, I'm hoping to, one, get out to a distillery because I want to write a little bit more in depth on that issue. And I'm thinking my farewell column at the end of the month may need to be about political polarization because I think it's been eye-opening experience to get the feedback that you get in today's incredibly partisan atmosphere to a column where you go out of your way to kind of criticize everybody on both sides of the aisle, and a lot of people are extremely loyal to their political party no matter what, and so you get a lot of flack for what some people call both sidesism.
Intellectual honesty be damned. You are a relatively new father. Biggest surprise in fatherhood that you're willing to share with us has been what?
You know, I think I'm surprised at how much fun I have with a baby who cannot yet talk to me and cannot yet really move that much. You know, I've been the sort of person who always, you know, was not as, you know, eager to like coo over a baby as perhaps my wife would be. But now that I have one, I am, you know, completely gung-ho for, you know, fatherhood and hanging out with my 5-month-old child.
Infants can even limit the crustiness of a newspaper, man, which is the power of an adorable baby, I think. Hopes or plans for your first Father's Day?
You know, I don't know. I hadn't really thought about it. It's going to be weird, I think, to be celebrated on Father's Day as opposed to it being a holiday where I just have to remember to call my dad.
Yes. My first Father's Day was last year, and it was a different, obviously new, but yes, also weird dynamic. Colin Campbell is the editor of the NC Insider. He's a columnist there for at least a few more weeks. You can follow him on Twitter at Raleigh Reporter. Colin, thank you for coming back on the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
As always, you can subscribe to the program, leave us reviews as well at iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Stay up to date with whatever is happening at your state legislature and in North Carolina politics at our website, wunc.org. For Colin Campbell, I'm Jeff Tiberi. Enjoy your weekend. We'll talk to you again soon.